Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Tonight's talk is from the 26th chapter, the last chapter of the Dhammapada, known as the Brahmanavaga. Brahmins during the Buddha's time were typically the priests. Brahmin was a priest. It really is only when you capitalize the word you're talking about a disincarnate enlightened being, but that's not something that the Buddha taught, but he used the phrase because it was common at the time. So the title simply refers to that act of being a true Brahmin, meaning being truly awakened. It's a culmination of the path. And so this entire chapter is the Buddha's description. I'll talk more about this on Saturday and throughout the Dhammapada structure study. The Dhammapada is considered by most scholars as like an instruction manual for novice. In other words, after the book was finally written down, novices would be given this as their beginning study guide. But it's a comprehensive look at the Buddha's Dhamma. It really could more or less stand alone. The dependent origination really isn't clarified in it, but it's included in there. When you hear Buddhist phrases out there, that, you know, whatever you might hear, usually they're corrupted parts of the Dhammapada. They took one or two lines and kind of created this pop culture Buddhism out of it. Most of those come out of the Dhammapada, but they're almost entirely misrepresented. This particular sutta is the last chapter in the book. The Dhammapada is written in such a way that, and you'll start learning this on Saturday, that each chapter feeds and builds to the next chapter, to where you really get to, now we've learned all the Dhamma. So the Buddha is now describing, if you think about it, put yourself in that place 2600 years ago. We're novice. We just spent 25 weeks or whatever it was learning the previous 25 chapters from senior monks and nuns in the Buddha Sangha. And so now the Buddha is teaching you a synopsis of what you've learned so far. So it's a direct teaching on what Dhamma practice looks like from the point of view of a skillful and awakened Dhamma practitioner. The Buddha uses two distinctions here. The skillful disciple, meaning someone who is practicing the Dhamma correctly, and the one who has achieved the goal, the Arahant. And it's so useful. This is another one of those suttas that if you ever feel a little lost in your Dhamma practice, read this and it brings you right back. The Buddha's words. And this is the one thing, one of the many things I want to point out. Listen to how the Buddha starts. Engage in right effort. That's all the instruction any real Dhamma practitioner needs, because once you understand what right effort is, it guides your entire practice. Engage in right effort. Root out the constant stream of craving. Abandon sense desires. Abandon sense desires. Don't mollify them. Don't coddle them. Don't try to embellish them in any way. Don't make them yours. Abandon sense desires. Know the destruction of all conditioned things. All conditioned things are mind concepts that are rooted in fabrications. Know the cool, calm peace of cessation. The skillful disciple is carefree and unfettered. They have abandoned craving and the objects of their craving. So as you're reading this, and as you're reading it in the future too, all you have to do is just ask yourself, have I achieved this yet? Is this true for me? And if it isn't, what do you do with it? Well, the first thing you do is be very gentle with yourself and acknowledge there's just a little more work to do. And be grateful and understand how fortunate you are that we've been given these clear and simple and direct teachings to reclaim our mind and reclaim our lives. The Buddha continues, they have abandoned craving and the objects of their craving. This one, I call an arahant. So if you want to know what awakening is, it's right here. Abandon craving. Those who are established in jhana, free of the defilements, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, passions cooled, remember the Loka Sutta, calm, the task complete, liberated from ignorance. Having reached the goal, these I call arahants. Again, there's nothing ambiguous about what it even means to be awakened. Again, I'm not saying these things to beat up modern Buddhism all the time, but the contrast is important for learning how easily we fall into conceptual ideas of what awakening might be. Excuse me. And so I've heard awakening described in so many ways, but they're all otherworldly. None of them were achievable by an ordinary human being, which is what the Buddha was and what the Buddha taught. You hear things like, one of the most constant refrains is that upon awakening, poof, you just vanish. What happened to the Buddha, the founder of all this thing? He awakened, he didn't vanish. He spent the next 45 years of his life teaching anyone who was interested. And then other things. There's a qualifications in most of Mahayana and strictly in Theravada Buddhism that you'll know you're awakened when you can recount all your past lives. The Buddha taught that anytime you have a thought going to the past, stop it, because it's all a fabrication. And yet much of awakening is based on that. You'll know your past lives. You'll be clairvoyant. You can read minds. You know how many sutras you've heard me teach that the Buddha says, if you even think about doing it, stop. There's no value in anything that's otherworldly or inhuman. And it's just perfect sense, isn't it? Why would I want to create an image of who I must be that's not attainable to me as a human being? Well, the only way I would do that is if I'm completely ignorant of who I am, a human being. That's ignorance. Ignorance obscures who and what we are, moment by moment. It's its purpose. The Buddha continues. The sun illuminates the day, the moon illuminates the night. The warrior shines in their armor. The skillful disciple shines in jhana. Arahants illuminate day and night. The arahant has abandoned all unskillful behavior, their mind concentrated and serene. Having renounced all of their impurities, they are true renunciates. True renunciates mean there's nothing left to renounce. You've done it all. A disciple should not be struck. If they are struck, they should renounce anger. So the Buddha is describing in a very simple way the unfairness of human life. Remember, he's talking directly to skillful disciples and arahants. He's saying that it's you should not be struck. But if you are, don't take it personally. Don't take anything personally. It's not ideal when you happen to get struck. But a wise Dhamma practitioner doesn't lose their mind over it. And getting struck is simply metaphor for any aspect of stress and suffering that would arise. From a disagreeable argument to getting hit by a safe.
It would also include thinking that when you pass, to think that there is no more you. And that's the model of I making.
Yes, yes. And of course, it's so obvious that's what the Buddha is talking about here, isn't it? Letting go of all self-referential views. When they are struck, they should renounce anger. Shame on those who injure anyone or give in to anger. I think the worst things I've ever, and again, I've never hurt anybody intentionally, except once. I did strike a person in anger when I was a teen, and I hated it. I can still feel my fist hitting this young kid's head. It was awful. And I bring tears in my eyes just thinking about it. Anyway, I kind of lost my place. Or give in to anger. The things that I'm most disappointed in myself about in my life in the past are things that were rooted in anger, that I acted out, saying things to people that they didn't deserve to be called. And isolating people from my life because I was angry with them. Or even directly. The most hurtful thing you can do to a child is to ignore that child. But the more I thought about it, I realized that aspect is true about a child and it's true about adults. The most hurtful thing you can do is turn your back on someone. I mean, we all feel that, don't we? We know when when we're not connecting with someone, when someone is dismissing us or the common culture canceling us, we feel it. And it's an awful feeling, isn't it? That's what the Buddha's talking about. These things that we do that we feel we have no control over. I'm mad at you, so I have to shun you. I have to turn my back on you or call you this or call you that because you made me feel that way. What am I describing when I say that? I'm going to call you a name because you made me feel bad. What is that describing? It's describing a human being who has lost their mind, isn't it? Or you couldn't possibly act that way. Of course, we all do it. And that might seem like it's too harsh to call that losing your mind, but that's exactly what it is. In that moment, when I'm calling you this or calling you that, or beating you over the head, or whatever else aberrant behavior might come out of that anger, it's rooted in a person who has lost their mind. And the Buddha realized that. This entire chapter is describing mental health, human mental health.
And he makes no distinction between the aggression and the reaction to the aggression.
It's the same thing.
It's the same thing, yep. And it's equally shameful.
It's equally shameful. And in understanding true karma, that's karma. There's no difference in what we're imprinting our minds with. It's the initial reaction that is the ultimate cause of all dukkha. And of course, a mind that's really uncontrolled has the reaction and then acts on the react. They act out on it, describing some of those things that I did. So this very simple teaching is getting to the absolute heart of all human misbehavior. And isn't it remarkable? This isn't some modern social scientist that figured this out with all kinds of tests and clinics and thousands of patients to observe. This is an old guy, well, not old, a 35-year-old man in northern India with no technology and nobody else around him. And yet he quieted his mind, reclaimed his mind, looked around at what was occurring and figured it out. And these teachings are still here today. The Buddha continues. Nothing is superior for the skillful disciple than wise restraint. Almost every class, there's an aspect of that in our class, isn't it? Practicing wise restraint. That also refers to where we practice a Dhamma in this moment as life occurs. There's no Dhamma in the past and there can be none in the future. There's only right here and right now as far as wise restraint. To the extent that anger and ill will is abandoned is the extent that suffering will subside. So if we're still there, if we're still not quite at the goal, look at ill will. Look at anger. We all have it. And it simply shows you where you need to recognize and abandon your fabricated views of yourself in relation to the world. Excuse me. Those restrained in thought, word, and deed, those are the middle sections, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Those that are restrained in thought, word, and deed, I call skillful disciples. So that's the beginning. The Buddha is describing a skillful disciple. This is any Dhamma practitioner. If we are restrained in thought, word, and deed, we are skillful disciples. Just as a Brahmin priest reveres his sacrificial fire, so should a skillful disciple revere the Dhamma taught by me. So again, during the Buddha's time, there was a lot of magical and mystical and sacrificial cults. And the Buddha's describing the comparison between what that is and what he teaches. It's two different things. The wise disciple reveres the Dhamma taught by me. It is not by matted hair or lineage or birth does one become a skillful disciple. So this points to the those that think that a Dhamma practice is an austere practice of showing how austere you are, which was very common. Remember, the Buddha did all these things. The first thing he did was he let his hair grow matty and long, and he stopped bathing. And for a long period of time, he walked around northern India naked because that's what true renunciants did. Of course, at the end of his that ordeal, he realized the foolishness of that type of behavior. It is not by matted hair or lineage or birth does one become skillful disciple. So we could be in the most well-known lineage. That ain't going to do it, a modern Buddhist lineage. That won't do it for you. There's no skill in following a lineage and claiming that that lineage goes back to the Buddha when it teaches something completely different. There's no lineage in Buddhism except a lineage that goes directly back to the Buddha's teaching, and that lineage is continued through actual Dhamma. There's no so-called Buddhist lineage. Just as an example, I'm not putting down Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism claims its lineage goes back to Dogen. Well, Dogen wasn't the Buddha. He taught something completely different. He taught something that we call now Zen, but it has no resemblance at all to Buddhism. But that's the lineage. But even though their lineage only goes back to Dogen, I think it was 6th century, but don't hold me to that. Do you remember Dogen?
Yeah, Dogen was, I think he was later. I think he was more like the 13th century.
That's right. Yep. So the modern Zen Buddhists would claim a lineage that goes all the way back to the Buddha, except the lineage can only go back to Dogen. And again, the only reason I'm bringing that up is the line that the Buddha says. It still rings true 2,600 years later when we're still making applying those misunderstandings to our Dhamma practice. It is not by matted hair or lineage or birth does one become a skillful disciple. That relates to the caste system in India at the time. And during that time, the lower classes couldn't forget about learning anything spiritual. If you happen to accidentally hear something you weren't supposed to, you were put to death. And no women were ever allowed to learn anything that was considered useful or spiritual. It just wasn't unheard of. That's what the Buddha's saying. By birth. It has nothing to do with the Dhamma. Those that know the Four Noble Truths and are free of conflict are skillful disciples. Know the Four Noble Truths and are free of conflict. Internal conflict.
Yeah, it's the internal conflict
here. Yes.
Because I was looking at that.
Well, in the context of this sutta, that the Buddha's talking about your qualities, your mind, isn't he?
Right.
Yeah. Free of conflict. So, I mean, that's what the Buddha's Dhamma ends conflict in our mind, and through that, it ends conflict in our world. You know, but it can't be the other way. I mean, the other thing that people get kind of messed up on is we want the world to change. You know, when the world is finally at peace, then I can be at peace. Well, it never happens. That's where you're falling. Matt and I had a long discussion about the most common mental illness on the planet today, the Messiah complex. Everybody's going to be the savior, you know, and every situation is here to save us. We're going to have absolute safety. Of course, none of these things are possible. There's no salvation on planet Earth. There's just human life. Yeah. That's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing that there's no salvation. In fact, the most hurtful things that human beings have done to other people has been in the name of salvation. And we're still doing it.
And it almost paralyzes your right effort.
Absolutely does.
To find ultimate sensation, because if we all can't do it, then nobody can do it.
That's right. That's right.
It's a little trick, so you don't really have to practice.
Yeah, you don't. But you're engaging in a distraction of Dharma practice.
And it might be good work.
I mean, you know, modern Buddhists do a lot of good things. They're just not practicing what the Buddha taught. Now, that's fine. You know, I think the only when they make me emperor of the world, one of the first things I'll do is to say that that you can only call what the Buddha taught Buddhism. You can call whatever you want. And you know, just to be fair, there's many Zen Buddhists that do understand that, and they don't call it Zen Buddhism. They call it Zen, and that's accurate. That's what it should be, because that's what it is. It's Zen. Well, you know, if you got to put an appellation after it, it's Zen religion, but it's Zen. That's great. That's what it is. And the only reason that is so the people that might be interested in Buddhism will actually be presented that. You know, and that's kind of what our responsibility is here. Let me continue. This is really a great couple of lines. What is the use of your matted hair or antelope hide? Foolish one. What is the use of that? The Buddha's talking about you keep putting on these robes to show you the appearance of some kind of practitioner. What does it make you? Makes you a foolish one. Within you is the tangle of passion. That's why you would put on an antelope robe or grow your hair in a certain way because of your passion to be something. And it's being something that you're not. When the Buddha says we become self or anything other than self, that's what he means. We create this fabricated view of ourselves and we live that fabrication. It is only outwardly that you cleanse yourself. You're not doing anything on the inside. The person who wears robes made of rags, lean, veins showing everywhere, who develops jhana in seclusion, this one can be called a skillful disciple. The description is not a description of someone practicing austerities. They're just simply living a simple life. They're not gluttonous, where you would put on fat and hide your veins. That's all that the Buddha is describing. It's not something that we should go and take that line, that one line out of everything the Buddha's taught, and say, oh, the Buddha's teaching us to starve ourselves and to practice. That's not what he's saying. Again, read it in context. I do not call a person a skillful disciple because of their lineage or their birth. If they continue to cling to worldly entanglements, they are just arrogant. Those who are free, and worldly entanglement is the belief that I am something or that I am anything. You know, an awakened human being doesn't consider themselves any special because they're Dhamma practitioners. They understand the impersonal nature of being a Dhamma practitioner. But there's no self-reference to being that. It's just simply who you are. Those who are free of craving and free of clinging to fabricated dharmas, I call skillful disciples. I'm going to read rather completely now without too much commentary, if I can. A person who has abandoned all fetters and clinging to wrong views, liberated from ignorance, trembles no more. There's no fear left in that. Remember the Loka Sutta, where there's fear, where there's desire, there's fear. Where there's craving, there's fear. I call this, how is that for not having any commentary? I call this person an arahant. A skillful disciple who has cut the bonds of hatred and craving, abandoned all wrong views, abandoned all defilements, released from ignorance, I call them an arahant. Does anybody think you can't achieve that, what the Buddha just described, becoming a fully awakened human being? I don't hear anybody saying no. It is. It's entirely possible, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing in that, what the Buddha's description of becoming an arahant that we can't do. A skillful disciple who has cut the bonds of hatred, we're doing that, aren't we, and craving. We have abandoned all wrong views and all defilements. We have released ourselves from ignorance. When we've done all that, we can call ourselves an arahant. It's all doable. A skillful disciple without ill will, who endures abuse and beatings and punishment, whose real power is patience, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who is free from anger, devoted to the Dhamma, virtuous, free of craving, well-restrained, unprovoked by ignorance, I call them an arahant. When the Buddha described himself as awakening, he says, there's nothing left within me to provoke another moment rooted in ignorance. Provoke another moment rooted in ignorance, meaning there's no ignorance left inside you because it's only ignorance that can provoke another ignorant moment. Like water on a lotus leaf or a mustard seed on the point, I'm sorry. When the longer I read, the harder it becomes. So I might have some of you start doing my reading. Like water on a lotus leaf or a mustard seed on the point of a needle, the skillful disciple who is free of clinging to sensual desires, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who in this very lifetime, not millions of lifetimes in the future, who in this very lifetime realizes the end of suffering, who has put down the burden of self-referential views and become liberated, I call them an arahant. In this lifetime. See, that's why you hear me say it over and over again. Awakening is right here and right now. It's not in some future time. It's in this human lifetime that we're designed to awaken. A skillful disciple with profound knowledge, wise, skilled in understanding the right and the wrong path. That's an important line. The Buddha's talking about real and false dharmas, the right and the wrong path, who has reached the highest goal, I call them an arahant. You have to make a decision at some point that this is the right path and that's the wrong path. a skillful disciple who is disentangled from householders and ascetics alike. That's a surprising line when you think about the time, because you were either a householder or you were an ascetic. And the Buddha is basically saying, you're all wrong. Ascetic alike, who wanders freely with no fixed abode, wanting little, I call them an arahant. And that can mean a person who owns the biggest house in town, no fixed abode. It simply means, as an awakened human being, you're not attached. You don't create an identity about having the biggest house on the block. You don't have to burn down the house and go live in a cave to achieve that, although it might be helpful to some people. A skillful disciple who has abandoned violence towards all living beings, including themselves, whether weak or strong, who neither kills nor causes others to kill, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who remains friendly in a hostile world, peaceful in the midst of violence. Not a lot of that going on today. Free of clinging amongst a clinging world. Free of clinging amongst a clinging world. I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple whose lust, hatred, pride, and hypocrisy have fallen away like a mustard seed from the point of a needle. I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who speaks with gentle, useful, and truthful words, free of ill will. I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who takes nothing not freely given to them, including emotionally, free of grasping, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who grasps after nothing in this world or any other world, speculative non-physical realms, any other world, free of desire, liberated, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who has developed perfect insight and is free of clinging to wrong views, free of doubt, free of the living death of ignorance, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who has abandoned the yoke of grasping after merit, that's much of modern Buddhism is about gaining merit, grasping after merit or clinging to demerit. How bad I am. Free of sorrow and regret, stain-free and pure, I call them an arahant. The skillful disciple who is as spotless, pure, clear, and serene as a full moon on a cloudless night, taking no delight in a fabricated existence, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who is no longer mired in this perilous and deluded world. So the Buddha is describing the world as it is, not how it should be, that it should be all peaceful, you know, everything should be wonderful. It's just the world. Who is no longer mired in this perilous and deluded world, who has crossed over the swamp of ignorance, their minds free of all doubt, resting in jhana, their passions extinguished, who have reached the goal, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who has abandoned sensual pleasures and the culmination of clinging to ignorance in any speculative and imaginary realms, free of all worldly entanglements, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who has cast off the yoke of eye-making in this world and in all fabricated realms, free of ignorance, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who has abandoned likes and dislikes, greed and aversion, who has abandoned all conditioned beliefs, who has established a calm mind through jhana, a conqueror of all worlds, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who understands impermanence and the arising and passing away of all beings, free of all clinging, truly fortunate and liberated, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who does not chase goals. A skillful disciple who does not chase goals, angels, devas, or human ideology, who has overcome all defilements, I call them an arahant. You could say that that's an entire Dhamma teaching in that one paragraph. A skillful disciple who does not cling to the past, present, or future, who is not holding on to or grasping after anything of the world, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple, noble, heroic, excellent, passionless, pure, a true conqueror of the world, totally liberated from ignorance, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who knows the arising and the passing away of all phenomena, who understands pleasure and pain, who has gained true insight into the three marks of existence, who can no longer give birth to even a moment of ignorance, who has reached the highest goal of understanding and calm, I call them an arahant indeed. That's tonight's talk. Thank you all for listening. let me just do a little housekeeping there. So is there anything that the Buddha taught here that, and honestly, please tell me, that you feel you cannot develop in your Dhamma practice?
Well, he's told you the first instruction.
Mm-hmm. Which is?
Right effort. And understanding what right effort is. And why not?
Why not, yeah.
So yeah. The answer to your question has to be, yes, it's possible. If not, why do this?
That's right. That's right. That's right. And here's another fellow human being, not a god, a fellow human being saying, you can do it. You know, this is it. You can do it. I did it. You know, many others have done it. Does anybody else feel like they can't do what was described here?
There was a time where I found these things, these chapters in the Dhammapada kind of daunting because it just kept piling it on. And I kept thinking, oh, Jesus, that too? You know, I've got to do all these things? And now it's more, it's actually hopeful. It's like, yeah, this none of this is bizarre, out of this world, unattainable. It's once you're a certain way into the Dharma, this is a hopeful thing.
Yeah, it is, and the
it's encouraging.
Yeah, that's really what the whole point. And there's a lot of that in the Buddha's, almost every sutta you can hear his encouragement about what you're doing. And this is, again, this is an instruction. He's describing in rather lengthy detail what it looks like. But the practice isn't this. The practice isn't all these things that Ram just mentioned. The practice is jhana meditation and developing the Eightfold Path. And along the way, there's teachings that support it. And then there's something like this that describe it. You know, so we don't even have to imagine where am I going? This and many other sutras tell me where I'm going. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, this is about a year ago, I started writing it out, about why the Buddha really taught these things that he did, and I couldn't make sense of my own writing, so I stopped doing that. But the Buddha had a, Siddhartha Gautama, we'll call him that, to put the humanist back in him. He awakened and had this profound understanding of what it is to be a human being. But he hadn't yet taught anybody. And what's remarkable to me as I read all the suttas is he figured out how to teach this most brilliant teaching in such a simple and direct way. And he did it. And he did it every day of his life for 45 years. And he never made it complicated. I mean, one of the things that I realized when I finally got what the Buddha was saying, it's only other people that made Buddhism so complicated and inaccessible.
And there are whole sections of Buddhism where the point is that you cannot understand.
I was told, so
it's the point.
I remember almost every, I won't mention the place because I know, but I spent a lot of time nearly every Sunday, and at least once a month, but sometimes four times a month, going to a certain place. And the first thing I would hear is that we're after awakening, but you can't awaken in this lifetime. It takes endless eons. And I was sitting there, and I couldn't help sitting there with 150 people thinking, well, wait a minute, why am I doing this? But I did it because of association, right? Because I wanted to be a part of this group. I was great friends with the head, again, I'm not gonna say who it is. And so it was, that was that association, and also the human beings, we gain a vested interest in keeping something going by putting some time and effort into it. And I didn't want to give up on it. When I admit to myself that I wasted my time, but I did. You know, stop talking
about
that.
That's wrong effort.
Yeah. And it was only, the only thing that got me out of all of my wrong effort was what the Buddha said here. It was by engaging in right effort. And it was by practicing the right path. That's the only thing that made a difference to me. Because when I even came to what the Buddha taught, I still wanted to keep remnants of the other path. There were still, you know, I still found myself years later having these kind of God or creator connected thoughts, almost like there was a movie that Jim Carrey did with somebody, he was on TV all the time, but he didn't know it.
Truman Show.
Yeah, it felt almost like I was thinking about myself in that way, even after I started developing, that God or something was over my shoulder watching everything I did. And it took a while to just kind of root that out because it was so pervasive in me. But of course, I was born into that culture where that's what you're taught. All right, let's go around the room. We'll start with Jane. Jane, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, John. I appreciate, as a teacher, I appreciate the way that the Buddha was able to break down his teachings in such a way that they were easily understandable.
Yeah, really. And they're just as accessible today, and they're just as useful today. It's remarkable. Glad you joined us tonight, Jane.
Thank you, John.
Hello, Matt.
John, good to see you. Thank you for this teaching. I really feel supported by our Sangha and the Buddha's Dhamma to keep this practice going. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Rob?
John. I'm finally becoming comfortable with the Dhammapada, actually. It's been a bit of a process. But specifically this one now, to see the encouragement in it, that's evaded me for a while. You can read this many times, and this is something where, if it's not a good day, this is one to pick up.
Yep.
And you get little vignettes, like this one little line of, he does not tremble.
Yeah.
That's just so great.
Yep.
To finally have a path or a practice where you're no longer acting out of fear, because 90% of what we do out of fear.
Yep.
Of whatever, like of doing things wrong, don't even know, but it's such a constant in human life that you
do something wrong, you can't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
Can't make a mistake.
And it becomes a physical feeling in your body that you're literally trembling.
Yeah.
And
it's all self-generated.
It's completely self-generated. Yeah. And here somebody says, there's no need for that.
Yeah.
Follow my path and you'll walk this earth without fear.
Yeah.
That's pretty huge.
Yeah. And again, you're pointing it right back to the pure Dhamma. Where there's desire, there's fear. Where there's no desire, there's no fear. And how could, again, it's just such an obvious statement, but it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Where does my fear come? My fear comes from not afraid of not getting what I think I need or want. That's fear. It's desire. Thank you, Ron. Hello, Brett.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Good to be here. Good to be with the Sangha. And feeling good. And what was the part on the goals? Is that the same thing like grasping after? Would be. So if you're goal, if like in the past I've been like goal oriented, it's never really got me anywhere after I achieve the goals, but it's so it just clinging and craving is basically, but I mean, is it still good to have? Probably still good to have goals, you think, or no?
Oh, remember that the Buddha's talking about the Dhamma and using the term loosely spiritual practice. And so he's teaching the people that have been involved in goals, like if you follow the Ten Commandments, if your goal is heaven, you follow the Ten Commandments. There's nothing but eye making in there, isn't it? That's what he's talking about. In a practical way, of course, there's nothing wrong with making a goal saying, you know, I'd like to get a nice house for my family. So in 3 years, I want to have $100,000 in the bank. That's fine as long as you don't lose your mind over that. In other words, if you only got 90,000, it's okay. You don't beat yourself up. You don't judge yourself as worthless or anything else. It's just an aspect of your moment by moment life. Mm-hmm. It's okay to make a goal, but don't plan the outcome. Mm-hmm. It's just living practically, but within liberation and freedom, because we don't entangle or imprison ourselves within our own views of ourselves in relation to the world.
By grasping after.
Yeah. By having to be anything other than what we are, and whatever we are at that moment. You know, and if in that moment we're eating hot dogs rather than steak, I'm just, you know, I don't eat much of either one of them, but it just means that today I'm eating hot dogs and maybe tomorrow I'm eating steak. And if I take eating hot dogs personally, I'm going to have an awful time till I get steak. And what if the steak doesn't come down quick enough? Then I got another bad day of eating hot dogs. And another, and another, and another. Or I can just simply not take any of it personally and have a hot dog. Take a rest. I'm glad you're here tonight.
Thank you.
Brett. Good to be here. David, good to see you tonight.
Well, John, thank you for your teaching.
Thank you for being here. Hello, Michael.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. I like reading this sutta. It was a little long, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. Julie and I read it, and we went over several different things in here. I like this again. You can go anywhere in here and pull something out of it, so I'm just going to go with this. A skillful disciple without ill will, who endures abuse and beatings and punishment, whose real power is patience, I call them an arahant. A skillful disciple who is free from anger, devoted to a Dhamma, virtuous, free of craving, well-restrained, unprovoked by ignorance, I call them an arahant. Unprovoked by ignorance. And we were talking earlier before about, like, if someone, like, strikes you or comes at you hard or whatever, with anger, and the skillful disciple doesn't react, right? So why doesn't he react? Well, the reason being is because he understands the three marks of existence. Yeah. He's integrated the three marks of existence into his life. So he won't strike out because he realizes that what is occurring is someone else acting out in an ignorant manner towards him.
Yep.
And also realizes that, yes, you know what, I understand that behavior because that used to be who I am, and that's the way I would act out when I didn't have an awareness of, you know, the three marks of existence, I'll leave it at that. I didn't have an awareness of the three marks of existence. So, again, I think that's obviously very important. And I like also the very last, how many pages are in this thing? Everyone, great. And then the closing statement, again, points to gaining insight into the three marks of existence as the focus purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma, the highest goal. And that's where that comes from. That's where that understanding comes from. And that's why the skillful, arahant or disciple, that's why he can maintain his calmness while other about him loses theirs.
Yeah, it really is just that simple and very well put. That's Dhamma practice. Yeah. Thank you. Hello, Julia.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. I also love this sutta. I love all the metaphors and things that it's very rich, you know.
Yeah.
The Buddha really, he must have been a beautiful speaker, you know. The one thing that came out to me was where he calls the warrior shines in their armor, the skillful disciple shines in jhana. So jhana is kind of like our armor.
It is, yeah.
You know, so it's important that it's one of the main things is to increase concentration, you know, and by increasing concentration, then we have a calm and peaceful mind, and we can deflect all those arrows that are coming at us through our jhana armor, you know?
Yep.
So that's the way I saw that. And then also the other
everything
thing...
Everything bounces off and nothing sticks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything is just deflected. It's just,
and that takes...
It
takes that the firewall of concentration to do that with life coming at you all the time.
Exactly.
And as you recognize, like Michael just said, when you recognize ignorance, you simply let it go. You don't have to react to someone or something or a situation, because all the world is rooted in ignorance. So why it can't be any different, and why should it be? It's just what's occurring. Viruses, you know everything else that seems to get people so upset,
mm-hmm.
It's just part of having a human life.
Exactly. And like a warrior, we have to be vigilant. We have to be vigilant and use wise restraint. And he mentioned it again. Where was that other line that I really liked? Let me see if I can find it. Nothing is superior for the skillful disciple than wise restraint. Restraint at point of contact.
Yeah.
So that says it all. That's the armor that we're wearing, and we have to be vigilant.
Yeah.
And you know, practice wise restraint when not in jhana meditation.
Yes. Thank you. Well said. So when you think about what Julia just said, what the Buddha teaches here, who is Brett? You mentioned goals, and what are they? The only goal that the Buddha, that is part of the Buddha's Dhamma, is understanding stress. But the Buddha says right view is a view that understands stress. It has abandoned the origination of stress. It has developed a path leading to the cessation of stress and had that experience of being unprovoked by ignorance. And so there's nothing ambiguous, magical, mystical, or unhuman or other human than about the Dhamma. Anybody can do it. It's simple. It's direct. It does take, as the Buddha said and David pointed out, it does take continued right effort. But anybody can do it. Again, that's why I asked that question over and over again, and not just in this chapter. Is there anything here that you don't think you can achieve? And there's nothing here. The Buddha doesn't teach anything that a human being can achieve, and as he says in this chapter, in this lifetime. That's the point.
I think people feel to answer yes would be arrogant.
Yeah.
But with the support of Sangha and the Sangha keeps you on the path of right effort.
Yep.
And to me, what other answer is there? And there is no arrogance, because your whole goal is to understand that it's not personal.
Yeah, the arrogance manifests in just the opposite way, doesn't it? In the Messiah complex mind, the salvation kind of mind, that, you know, I got to practice here that when you die, that would be a little bit mocking. When you die, you're going to get some kind of reward. Well, that's the essence of arrogance, isn't it? Because you're lying to me. You know, lies are rooted in arrogance. So don't tell me that I'm getting a reward by doing something that you want me to do in this lifetime. Because what I want to know is, how do I live this next moment? How can I live peacefully this lifetime? That's the most important thing. And if I get that mastered, maybe then I'll think about otherworldly things. But guess what? The more I develop the Dhamma, the less I'm concerned about otherworldly things. What do I care? What do I care about speculating about something that I can't possibly know? Maybe there is life after death, somehow. It's not something the Buddha taught, and it's not something I'm concerned about. Why? Because if there is, I'll find out when I get there. But if I'm concerned about it, if I spend my moment-by-moment life acting in a certain way so I can be sure that I'll get this reward, I'm not living this life. And that's what the Buddha recognized. It's what I was concerned about when I was 13, 14, 15, 16 years old and confused as hell about all these things that I was being taught that were important in life, because none of them seemed important, at least foundationally important. I mean, I understood the idea of, you know, getting a good job, going to college, and all the rest of that stuff. But that all seemed ancillary to me of understanding life. And looking at that, it seemed more important to try to figure it out rather than not. Of course, I was also drinking quarts of vodka every day and doing all kinds of other things, so it took me a while to get around to it. But when you realize it, when you hear something like this, or you practice in a well-focused sangha like we have here, it really is simple and direct, isn't it? We just have to do it. And we're so fortunate here in Cross River Meditation Center. I always got to go back to Matt. We have Cross River, I haven't said in a long time, Cross River Meditation Center is here, not because of me, it's because of Matt. I just happen to be fortunate enough to teach here. But it's remarkable how, just what we did just now, going around the room, we offer such support, and to me too, to such support to each other in developing the Dhamma. This is true community. You know, this is really what community is about, and that's not to say there's not other types, but this type of community, coming together, communing on the truth, on the reality, is one of the most powerful things any of us will ever experience, and we experience in a very gentle way, don't we? Because it's a gentle Dhamma. It can only be experienced that way. That's why I hear you say it all the time. I said it about 10 times today to one person. You got to be gentle with yourself. They were just coming out of a psych hospital, actually. You need to be gentle with yourself right now. And we all do. Yeah, we all do. And that's something else that the Buddha says in here all the time. Okay, that's enough. So Saturday we're going to start our 26th class study, culminating again with this. So you'll hear this again in 26 weeks. But any other comments or questions on tonight's class? Any comments or questions on our 26, I guess it was 26 or 27 class study we've just finished tonight?
I really enjoyed it.
Did you? Yeah. Found it useful? Yeah, it's been a bunch of these suttas that I wanted to teach for a while. I have taught them in other ways, but in this way, just as part of the study, and I think it worked pretty well. It'll be a book one of these days if I can ever get it done. All right, let's finish with metta, as we always do. So again, just gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. See you, Jane.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.